The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Spurs pull out all the stops as the Go Compare man opens the new stadium. A humdrum win over Crystal Palace means the top four is still in their hands. It's not in Manchester United's as they lose to Wolves again as Mike Dean brandishes his 100th red card. Elsewhere, City go back to the top and Fulham are relegated. Another week where racism hits the headlines, this time in Italy with monkey chants and ill-thought-out post-match interviews. We'll round up the rest of Europe. We'll look ahead to the FA Cup semi-finals, talk selfie celebrations going wrong and referees vomiting on the pitch. All that plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Greg Bukowski, how's the title race for your stress levels, Greg?
It's about a good 9.89.
Jonathan Wilson, how sad are you after the Checker trade defeat?
Philosophical.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I feel privileged now that I've seen Sunderland at Wembley four times and we've lost in the finals of four different competitions. And there's not many people can say that. And when we make it five next month by losing in the final of the League One playoff, that will also be, in its own way, an achievement. But we beat Accrington 3-0 last night, and in some ways...
That's more important, yeah. Paolo Bandini, how are you?
I'm pretty good, yeah.
Nice to see
all
you.
All being considered.
Marvellous. Let's start with Wolves' victory over Manchester United 2-1. Three defeats in four for Manchester United. Their worst run of the season, Wilson. Worse than any of the runs they had under Jose Mourinho. What's happened?
He's hopeless, isn't he? It's been a disaster to appoint him. And United are locked in this downward spiral for the rest of time. Or they play quite well and Wolves hit them twice on the break, as Wolves are prone to do, and took their chances. I mean, I actually think United played better in that game than they have done for two or three weeks. So I've always been a slight Solskjaer sceptic. While acknowledging they probably had to give him a job, I would have waited till the end of the season. My opinion hasn't particularly changed this week.
Craig Burley, no less, said appointing Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was emotional claptrap. No, sentimental claptrap.
Yeah, well, apologies if I'm misattributing here. I believe I was on this podcast and it was Jonathan or... maybe it was someone else who was saying exactly at the time of the appointment, why do you make the appointment now when it's not yet necessary, when you could make it at the end of the season anyway? You're not under any pressure to make it now, and you don't know yet how he's going to react to adversity, Solskjaer. Now, I don't think we need to sort of throw him under the bus here. I think, as Jonathan's just said, they actually played better against Wolves than they did against Watford a few days before. But it's a valid question that was raised at the time, whether or not you actually needed to make the appointment when you made it, when there is still a bit of the season to go and you don't know.
I thought that's down to trying to seal contracts with players and give him some stability in the dressing room. If they like him and they want to play for him, then if you've got players who you really need to tie down on contracts, then maybe that's why they chose to make the appointment.
And I think at the time it did feel sort of very... I don't know, very optimistic and obvious that this was going to be fine. I guess now there is just that little niggling doubt of, if they don't make the Champions League, will there be any regret about it? And it's going to be tight now for the Champions League. I think I probably still have them edging in, having looked at the fixtures to come, but it's tight.
The second time Wolves have beaten United 2-1 in the last 2.5 weeks. They did it in the Cup as well.
This season, yeah, they've had 14 league games when they dominated possession, which they only won four. They've had 18 in which they've had less of the ball, and they've won 9 of those. So they're a lot better without the ball.
And they can do both, though. They're a strange team to watch at times. I mean, going back to the FA Cup game against United, there were times when they played on the counter-attack and didn't seem to be interested in having the ball for 10, 15 minutes, and then they suddenly switched, and the midfield three were very happy and comfortable on the ball, and they do seem to be able to switch between the two styles of play, which perhaps confuses opponents, which is why one reason maybe why they've done well.
How much potential do Wolves have next year to try and bridge that gap? It is a big gap, but they've lost some weird games this year, as Barry was saying on Monday, twice to Huddersfield, to Cardiff as well, and a few others.
Yeah, I mean, they've got to find a way of playing when they can't just counter-attack. Yeah, that's clearly what they're best at. I don't know how much possession they had exactly on Tuesday night, but
it was very close to 50-50.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, they were a shade under, but it was very close.
Right. In the 11 games when they've had less than 40% possession this season, they've only lost twice. And one of those was a game against Manchester City when they were down to 10 men after 19 minutes, I think it was, when Boly was sent off. So, yeah, they're very good when they don't have the ball.
Can you then just give the ball?
That's exactly what I was just thinking, because you think the team that's playing its first season in the Premier League, part of what you have going for you is teams aren't used to seeing you yet. And in a year's time, is everyone wise to this? Wolves are better off without the ball. But then exactly as Max says, what do you do? Are you going to just give them the ball? There's not a...
Well, then obvious. Both teams are just giving each other the ball, right?
you've got to find a creative player who can unpick pack defences, and you've got to work out a way of getting the balance right so that you can also defend and not get caught on the break when you do have the ball. So, they've got to... And it's true, I think certainly of all mid-table sides, they've got to work out two different ways of playing. Hmm.
Well, and switch immediately. I mean, that's sort of the same way of playing, right?
Well, no, to have one way of playing into teams who are better than you where you will have less of the ball, and one way of playing where you expect to dominate the ball. And that's not easy. You know, one of the big criticisms of Jose Mourinho at Real Madrid was he didn't coach them how to play against packed defences. Mm. He was fine when they could sit back and hit teams on the break, but wasn't necessarily very good at breaking down. Was it Getafe they had big problems with repeatedly?
Do you know what's sort of an extra level, I think, of interesting to that? Is
an extra level extra of interesting. Level. This is, I'm standing by to be seriously interested
I've already,
now.
I've already overhyped it, and now Max has taken it even more.
It's the testimonial of the pod, an extra level of interesting.
I was just thinking about Simone Inzaghi at Lazio, who also play counter-attacking football and thrive at it. And one of the things that's been notable about that Lazio team is that they sort of consistently produce some of their best games against Juventus, against the team that's hardest to beat in all of Italy. They've outplayed them a number of times since Inzaghi's been there. And what's weird about that is you almost get this idea that Inzaghi's a big game manager, like he's the one who can sort of work out the big games, and that's a thing to be lauded. But actually what it really means is Juventus are one of the teams who'll try and dominate them, who will say, okay, yeah, we'll take the ball off you and play to your hands to a certain extent. So it almost makes a manager look like he's a big game manager, but what you forget is... Yeah, he's maybe not a small game manager at the same time.
Wolves play wing backs as well. I always think with wing backs is that how the game pans out is harder to predict than if you get two formations which are more closely aligned with two teams playing four at the back. Because Wolves can completely pile the players forward, push the wing backs up, or revert to like a back five and be very, very solid. So I think that's possibly why possession stats are a bit warped.
The other thing with Wolves that we don't know yet in terms of how they may be next season is what happens when bigger clubs start to look at their players. Are they prepared to sell or not? Mm. I'm not sure necessarily who would be being looked at the moment. Maybe Doherty, if he were looking for an attacking right back.
Jota or Neves, I guess.
I don't know
what their contract situations are.
Yeah.
Jimenez looks like it's rumoured to be signing this week for 13 million. Is he the new Steve Bull?
Yes, that's exactly what he is. They've... Yes, the Portuguese ball.
Or is he going to score two goals Toro. Next season?
Steve O'Toro.
I don't know that is the Portuguese ball, I'm guessing.
But. If you haven't seen Phil Jones' face, the photo of it as Chris Smalling puts the own goal in, he's done that face before. And
I thought it was Photoshopped. I've got to say, I had to keep looking at it because I thought, there's no way that is a real picture. That's kind of been touched up because it was too Phil Jones.
It was marvellous, wasn't it? Lord Keir says, following the events of midweek, will we finally stop the pointless debate as to whether Mike Dean isn't among the greatest referees of all time? Adam Hurry at Football Clichés, I would absolutely buy a Mike Dean's 100 red cards VHS cassette. I was sad that he didn't have a T-shirt underneath and just run to the corner flag.
And then book himself.
Yeah.
Has a referee ever had a statue? Because I think he's worthy of a statue.
Where would you put it?
Well, he's from Heswall on the Wirral, so he could be just with his card in his hands, just looking out towards the Welsh hills in the distance.
Well, that's nice. I mean, no, it should be that the advantage when he sort of looks like Tardelli.
Yes, a referee has had a statue. Tofik Bakramov.
Really?
He was the Azerbaijani linesman who gave Jeff Hurst goal in the 66 World Cup final. There's a statue of him unveiled by his son before England played Azerbaijan in, I want to say, 2005. Horrendous weather, I remember. And the stadium is named after Tofik Bakramov. So, yes.
But, it's what you're here for, Will.
Yeah. Sub-editor's fact check, please.
Estebao Toro. is Steve Bull in Portuguese. So Raul should sign and then change his name to Estevão Toro. So Manchester United in the race for top four, 61 points from 32 after yesterday's results. Chelsea 63 from 32. Arsenal 63 from 31 and Spurs 64 from 32. A much needed victory for Spurs. The unveiling of the stadium. I was there, and I think the interesting thing is doing a piece where we're sort of interviewing fans outside, and you say, "Oh, you know, are you coming home?" But actually, genuinely, there was, I suppose, completely understandably, some like real sort of raw emotion from some of these Spurs fans about just looking at the stadium. Honestly, you stood at the front, and the number of fans who clearly hadn't been to the two test events, who sort of stopped and then just gawped at this enormous thing, and you know, just seeing grown-ups getting very emotional about what was essentially a stationary object was quite powerful, actually. And at the opening ceremony as well, I say the Go Compare Man. I'm pretty sure it was the Go Compare
Yeah,
Man.
It was.
But it was quite, I mean, I wouldn't say understated, it was noisy, but the noise from that wall, because I stood in there for that bit, was quite incredible, actually. I mean, 10 minutes into the game when nothing had happened, all you could hear was the Palace fans. And there was a real nervousness about the fans, obviously, the first one. They're just desperate for a goal. But it's football stadiums are amazing things, aren't they?
Yeah. I haven't been in, I wasn't there for the game, but I was outside there to do a bit of filming the other day. And what I found really appealing about it, I have to say, is the thing which I used to get as an Arsenal fan when it was the old Highbury, is when you sort of can come around a corner and just sort of see a football stadium. Mm. You haven't noticed it, except that, you know, unlike with Highbury, when you actually notice it, it's looming over you. It's huge. You know, you can be in a street adjacent to it and not know it's there. And then you come around the corner and suddenly there's this colossal testament to football right in front of you. And it's very striking. I think it's, I mean, again, I haven't been inside, which you have, Max, but I thought it's very sort of, it makes an impression on you.
I live in Tottenham, about a mile away from the ground, and the whole time it's been being built, I know a few season ticket holders, and they have been kind of yearning to get there. And local businesses as well have been quite badly affected by the fact that it didn't open on time. And it's great for them that it finally has. But, I mean, I don't know. It feels like there's so much being invested in it now that they really need to make it work. And the amount of money that it's cost, they've got this shiny new stadium, that's all very well. It's like buying a really expensive new car, but if you now haven't got money to put petrol in it and keep it running, then I think next season will be key to their hopes, I think.
Well, I think this was why this actually wasn't sort of treated as such, I didn't feel it necessarily in the build-up, but this was actually, it was not a gimme for Tottenham. It was a really high-stakes game because they've taken, 1 point from the last five games. You're playing a Palace team that is better away from home than it is at home in the Premier League, certainly in terms of results. I think people looked at it and thought, oh, this new stadium will give Tottenham this immediate lift and they'll be able to roll over teams, which with time I think will probably happen. But again, sort of call back to previous pods, but I remember talking, this was probably years ago, on a pod which you were on, Greg, and we were talking about why home advantage makes such a big difference in the Premier League, when often the atmosphere isn't that great in the Premier League at some games, right? It's not like every game you're getting a sort of raucous atmosphere.
Well, there's an expectation which can put more pressure on players in home games in the Premier League, I'd say.
Absolutely, but you talked about the comfort, the sort of knowing where the kettle is, which was, you know, maybe not literally with a kettle, but that thing of sort of knowing where you are. And the Tottenham players don't have that yet. They'll get that, but they don't have it on day one. So you don't have actually all of the advantages that you would normally have from playing at home, which is just knowing your environment better than your opponents do. On top of which you have this pressure that you absolutely need to win because it's the first game in the new stadium. On top of which you have the pressure of, we've just taken 1 point from five games. I think there was a lot on Tottenham in this game, actually.
In some ways, I do think the Wembley move may help them as being a buffer, unlike Arsenal, where it was straight from Highbury, you know everything. You know where the kettle is.
Yeah.
You go into the Emirates, you don't know where it is. They've had to go through that experience at Wembley, and after the Champions League games, which were a disaster at the beginning for them, they finally got to grips with Wembley in the Premier League and have done very well. So they have got some experience of having to adapt, and that will serve them well, I believe. And also they've just got to get on with it now. It's not the beginning of the season. It couldn't be any more pressure on them, really.
Where do you keep your kettle? Next to the toaster? It's got to be, surely.
No, it's not next to Tosa's on one side of the cooker, kettle's on the other.
Oh,
underneath the cups. It obviously makes
Jonathan
sense.
Looks yeah. so concerned.
I mean, are they lonely?
They're not matching. They didn't come as a set because we had.
That's all right. I mean, we had
a builder come round.
I'm not pro incest.
Yeah. Okay. We had a builder come round who thought our kettle was one that you put on the hob, and it was an electric kettle, and he put it on the hob and burnt and melted the kettle. So we had to buy a new one, which wasn't part of the set, which he offered to pay for, which we're very grateful for.
I think producer Jonathan wants us to talk about the game.
I was paying very little attention there because I was just checking. There's an Ethiopian referee called Inakechi Tesema. He was also a great administrator. And there is a stadium named after him in Addis Ababa, but not it seems, a statue.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I just thought I'd... just in case people thought we were ignoring Inakechi Tesema. There was, I didn't see the game live, but there was some suggestion on Twitter that it appeared there was a sort of conscious effort for Harry Kane to score the...
Well, they got a free kick 25 yards out, and Eriksen and Trippier were both over it, and Harry Kane sort of picked up the ball to take it. Danny Rose was through in the first half down the left, and he was playing left wing, which was interesting, but he did quite well in the second half at Anfield in that position, didn't he? And he was put through, and for some reason squared it to or tried to pass it to Kane when... I mean, he wasn't out wide. It was take a touch and have a go. So I can see why those conspiracies were there, but I probably think that Danny Rose is just not used to being a left winger.
Who are you going to back to score? I guess, you know, you give it Kane. Let him do the business.
I haven't seen Spurs in person yet this season, and Sissoko is such a joy, right? I mean, we all know there's a sort of comic element, right? But and there's a randomness to his play, but he's almost impossible to play against because he's literally everywhere. It's quite extraordinary as a player. I mean, producer Jonathan knows, you know, they've got these players that are all so different. Eriksen, Ali, Sissoko, Son and Kane. And that's a sort of glorious thing that they're all, they contribute very different things to a game of football.
They've essentially replaced Moussa Dembélé with Sissoko, which is quite something given the kind of player that Dembélé was before he, well, saw China.
Yeah, but he had wonderful close control and could beat people in a different way to Sissoko. Mm.
I was just thinking about first goals in new stadiums. It's something that Jonathan was picking up when we were talking before the podcast. Eriksen looking very much like a man who had in his mind he wanted to score the first goal in the stadium and perhaps was trying to give it a bit of extra welly at times.
Well, it was Peter Drury's commentary on it. Was you know, he was really screaming kind of names. Because he obviously knew that the goal was going to be replayed a lot. So I know Peter Drury is somebody who, you know, who is quite emotional in his commentary, and all the better for it. But he did seem to be particularly kind of screaming, Eriksen!
Yeah. Sort of like a computer game.
As the ball trickles kind of gently. To...
26 shots from 9 different players. There you go. So everyone was trying to have a go. That's like when I've played a few charity games at Wembley. And literally everyone from 50 yards just has a pot shot. Eriksen had 6, Kane had 7, 10 on target in total. The title race then, Greg, City 80 points from 32, Liverpool 79 from 32. A sort of regulation win for Manchester City over Cardiff yesterday. First start for Phil Foden. We pay a lot of attention to him not playing, I guess, a bit like Hudson-Odoi, mainly because he's young and English.
Yeah, I mean, so we now know how many games it takes for a young 18-year-old English player to get a start in the Premier League at Man City or Chelsea, which is 32 games. Both have shown enough quality, I think, this season that they could have started more. You could have started games earlier than that, but I thought Foden he just seamlessly slipped into the team yesterday, and he's obviously been schooled very well in what Guardiola wants. His passing's always forward, but they were playing Cardiff at home, and who I think ventured into the City penalty area twice in the first half. So it was like watching a training game, and it's interesting with City. I mean, they've had a number of games this season where they probably could have scored 5 or 6 goals and haven't and have just won narrowly, like at Fulham as well. But they're just in the groove now, Manchester City, and it feels like the games that they're winning, the result isn't really in the balance in the same way as the games that Liverpool are in.
Yeah, you feel like they come off the pitch and don't feel like they won't feel physically tired.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Liverpool are absolutely putting everything into their games to get the 3 points, where the City are kind of just jogging around. In the end, I know Jonathan's alluded to this before, that could work in Liverpool's favour when City do have a test, because when teams do get so comfortable in games that they're tested defensively, sometimes they're not quite as at the races as opponents are, whereas Liverpool have been tested defensively time and again this season, and that's what
this hope talking.
That's what's kept them in this race. The defence has been fantastic.
Manchester City have conceded just 3 shots on target in their last 5 Premier League games. I feel it's ominous. I know what you're saying, but it just feels ominously like they haven't, since the Newcastle game, they've won every game.
So is Edison still match fit?
He had one save to make, didn't he? The sign of a great goalkeeper is when it can be quiet for 89 minutes.
Or 4.5 games.
Yeah. 4.5 games.
I'd say both Liverpool and City now, the next 3 games are key, because they are, of the 6 games, they're probably the most difficult. Southampton are still looking for points. I mean, the bottom of the Premier League isn't, it's pretty much decided, I'd say. Cardiff slightly in the balance, but I can see them going down. But Southampton are looking for points. Chelsea, Liverpool play Chelsea at Anfield. They're obviously really desperate to get into that top 4. And then Liverpool play Cardiff away, who may still be at the point of desperately seeking points. And City got Crystal Palace away, which is, again, they still need a few points. And I know Crystal Palace haven't been great at home, but they can come up with surprising results.
And they got a draw against City last year and had the penalty in the last minute to win it.
They ended the run of wins, didn't they, with that draw?
Yeah.
And they've got Spurs at home, and then they've got Manchester United away. So I think we could know much more in 3 games' time.
Well, we probably will, won't we? Fulham are down. They lost 4-1 at Watford. We all knew it was going to happen. An email from Doug Statt, who says, without being too dramatic and football started in 1992 focus, surely Fulham's relegation must go down as one of the meekest and generally worst relegations in the history of sport. He says, a very good squad, over 100 million spent, 76 conceded. The only reason they didn't join Huddersfield and Derby in being relegated by April is the huge one-game new manager bounce Ranieri managed to produce. Do you go with that?
I mean, given the amount they spent, it's been pretty pathetic, yeah.
They haven't got any leaders on the pitch. I think Mitrovic up front looks like he's got a bit about him. But I think the other day Ryan Babel took the armband. I mean, he joined on a short term deal in January, and it's Ryan Babel we're talking about here.
Nice bloke, right?
He's a nice bloke. Yeah, yeah. But with all, if you've got turmoil off the pitch from a management point of view, you need some kind of level of consistency.
It also shows, you know, when you're signing players and when you're sort of preparing the structure of a team, that the ethic and the spirit that's carried you through the previous season, you've got to be really careful about not messing that up. So it's very easy to sort of go through the whole team and go, right, this guy's got, I don't know, pass completion 78%, this guy's got 82%, so we'll swap for this guy. But what do you lose by replacing him? And that's clearly been one of Fulham's biggest problems this season, is that the core of last season's team has vanished.
Yeah, every ex-pro I've talked to about this has talked about a rift in the dressing room, saying, you know, if you bring that many players in and you ditch... Okay, they lost a couple, didn't they? Lost Matt Target, who was really important to them. They lost Ryan Fredericks as well. So they did have to replace some players who'd been crucial in that season last year. But they say, look, when you bring lots of players in and you relegate the other guys to the bench that have got you up, you just don't have a dressing room that are together, unless you have a brilliant manager, I guess, who can negotiate around that.
Yeah, but I mean, I think any manager, when you're making that many changes, it becomes almost impossible. Yeah, if you bring in 2 or 3 new players, which is kind of what you have to do, maybe even more than that, that's something a manager can deal with. Yeah, 5 or 6 new players, how do we fit them in? How do we cope with the old players whose teammates may sort of feel sympathy for them? Yeah, that is something a manager can handle. But if you're bringing in 9 or 10 new players, I think that becomes almost impossible.
Sam Dean, writing in the Telegraph of Andre Frank, Zambo and Guisa, he says, I think has a good claim for being the worst signing in Premier League history. Wastes a promising counter-attack by passing the ball straight into touch. The fans sing, that's why we're going down. I think he cost something like £30 million. I don't know. I mean, the worst is...
is a...
There are lots of bad ones, but
good
still.
Good competition there, yeah.
Scott Parker lost all five games since taking over as caretaker manager, letting in 13, scoring 4. You can't blame him, right, for this situation, but by the same token...
Well, he hasn't done a Darren Moore, has he? He's done nothing to suggest that he would effect brilliant change. Now, it might be people around the club who watch him in training things can say, well, no, things have changed and it is worth giving him a go. But on the games themselves, he hasn't done anything to enhance his cause. But as you say, you can't... You know, he and Jan Sievert, I think, have been placed in impossible positions and have ended up sort of ruining their sort of credibility for next season through inheriting a mess. I think if you're going to get rid of a manager with sort of, you know, 10 games a season to go, you've almost got to give the job to somebody who you've got no intention of appointing, like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, or Sunderland did giving it to Kevin Ball, who's never going to be in the picture. Solid club man. Doesn't matter if Kevin Ball loses 10 games out of 10, because you're not going to appoint him the next season.
It's funny because now I'm thinking about what Greg just said and thinking Fulham almost could have benefited more from Scott Parker on the pitch than on the sideline, the way things
possibly
have been.
So if you inherit a mess, how many games, if you want the job next season, you should wait to, what, 3 games left?
Well, Darren Moore had 4, didn't he?
Yeah.
Or 5, maybe.
Something like that.
Did he win 4 out of 5, I think? But, I mean, ideally, you just don't take it. You keep at the firing line.
What would be the most sentimental, claptrappy appointment?
Noel and Liam Gallagher, joint managers of Manchester City.
Get rid of Pep with 5 games to go.
Yeah.
It would be box office, though, isn't it? You can't say you wouldn't be more excited to find out what City did.
Can you imagine the documentary? The sing-alongs would be immense.
Yeah, Real Madrid have openly said that they feel they're like Disney, a content producer, and that is undeniably great content.
That's a marvellous idea. Right, anyway, that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two with Chelsea's win over Brighton.
It's time to focus.
The mood in the UK right now, it seems to me, is a huge set of tensions and contradictions and emotions and feelings about our past, and we're not thinking very much about the future.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part 2 of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. 2 live shows. Come to them both, please. 22nd of April, SWG3 in Glasgow. Me providing the enthusiasm, Barry, Ewan and Jonathan bringing me back down to earth with a bang. Are you looking forward to it, Wilson?
Yeah, but that week is going to be really exciting.
Because?
I'm doing Glasgow and then I'm going to Copenhagen and Odense to do a thing for the Danish FA, which annoyingly means I'll be in Copenhagen for the Manchester Derby. And then I'm coming back and I'm going to the Lake District.
What are you doing for the Danish FA?
They've got a conference on the future of football and they've decided to pay me to tell them about the future of tactics.
What's the future of tactics? I mean, how long have we been going too long already? What is it's in a nutshell?
I mean, it's embargoed. I can't.
Is that right?
I can't possibly tell you when I haven't written it yet.
Okay. the day after, 23rd of April, we drop Wilson. We bring in bouncy Norwegian-Irishman Lars Sivertsen to join me, Barry and Ewan, at Elmwood Hall in Belfast. Please come. Chelsea 3, Brighton 0. 3 lovely goals. Olivier Giroud's goal, Paolo, was a thing of total joy. Hudson-Odoi, embarrassing Anthony Knockhart. And the flick from Giroud was genius.
I mean, I think Olivier Giroud scoring goals is often a thing of joy, isn't it? But it was a lovely goal. And I suppose all the more so, especially for Chelsea fans, for the fact that it's involving younger players. That it's these guys who they've been wanting to see in the team more all season, finally. Perhaps too late, we'll find out, but finally getting their run under Mauricio Sarri as well.
Is he underrated? I mean, I've always thought he was great. 6th in his last 6 games for club and country, but only a second league goal. Higuain's come in, 10 weeks ago, started more league games than Giroud.
Yeah, I've heard this question has come up a few times with Giroud at different points in his career, and I think it's never for me been that Giroud is necessarily underrated, but some strikers alongside him are overrated, if you know what I mean. I think Giroud is rated about right, but then there are some who get by dint of reputation, by dint of I don't know, being a bit more
good at football.
Well, again, it's always a question with strikers, isn't it, Jonathan? Is it about being good at football, or is it about how good you are at putting the ball in the net, which are two different things?
And that's actually, I think the comparison with Giroud and Higuain is really interesting, because I think both of them are guilty of the same fault, which is they have a horrible tendency to miss big chances in big games.
Yeah. Mm.
And that was the problem with Giroud at Arsenal, that every time they got to a big Champions League game, he would have a shocker. And so that was always a doubt about him. You know, he's fine at scoring goals against mid-table and below, but doesn't score the big goals.
Yeah,
I mean, that might, you know, problem with that is it's not a huge sample size, so it might be coincidence or it might be some temperamental flaw. But Giroud always seems somebody who, once he missed a chance early in the game, his head would drop and things would rapidly deteriorate.
He seems to be valued for bringing other people into the game as well, and one of those plays is on the pitch and kind of brings things together in the way it's
a Heskey style.
Well, yeah, Heskey style, or just, you know, like when you go out and one of your mates is out who you all really like, it's, oh, he's out tonight, we'll have a good time. I feel like Giroud's like that in the dressing room, in the team. It's like, oh, he's on the pitch, so things might work.
But maybe
a bit
not
better.
In New Year, not on a really big night.
No. You don't want him to try and, like, you know, jump over the fence or something. Something's going to go wrong there.
Do you know what's interesting about that is that Higuain, I don't know if he always gets enough credit for this, I think that Higuain is also a player who actually is quite selfless for someone who scores that many goals. He does put work in for the team. He does actually move. In fact, he was criticised for it by Gattuso at Milan for spending too much time outside the box, for spending too much time sort of coming back and trying to help link play. But I don't feel like he has that same image at all as Giroud has, as someone who's like that. Giroud has this sort of very warmly appreciated image, and Higuain, I think, I don't know if it's to do with the way that he carries himself.
And the goals he scored, I guess. He scored a vast amount of goals in the last few seasons, which he's remembered for more so than the other stuff.
A lovely finish from Loftus-Cheek as well, wasn't it? Just bent into the top right-hand corner. Looked beautiful in super slow-mo. Arsenal 2, Newcastle 0. Arsenal briefly went above Spurs, which was exciting for them. Aaron Ramsey getting another one.
They should sign him to a new contract, shouldn't they?
I know we've said it before, but it seems such a shame for them. But equally fascinating to see how he does for Juventus, Paolo.
Yeah, I found the reaction to him from other people I know cover Italian football very cool, and I think there's this sort of perception that because Arsenal have fallen outside the Champions League place, everything attached to them is completely worthless, which I think is absurd. He was Arsenal's best player last season. He contributes to a huge number of goals. I don't know if he fits at Juventus is the thing that I struggle with. I look at the types of midfielders they have and what I think they need more of, and what I think they need more of desperately is an alternative to Pjanic, someone who can sort of sit comfortably at the back of midfield. They don't necessarily need someone like Ramsey, who breaks the lines, who fits between the midfield and attack. I feel like it's not something they're necessarily short of, but I think he's easily talented enough to be a useful player for Juventus, and I think he could be a hit there. We'll find out.
Just 10 shots in the whole game from Opta Joe. Only two Premier League games since August 2003 have had fewer shots in total than Arsenal Newcastle. He scored out half an hour with the first shot of the game for either side. Half an hour. They should have just started after 30 minutes, couldn't they? Lacazette's finish was lovely. And also that clearance from Matt Ritchie. Lacazette absolutely pelts that, and he's on the line and he heads it wide somehow. Very and very impressive. This weekend in the Premier League, Friday night, Southampton, Liverpool, chance to go 2 points ahead of City. Who won't play their game in hand until the Manchester derby on the 24th of April. So does that mean they will be constantly playing catch-up for that whole time? Which is better? It's better to go first, right?
It's better to be ahead, yeah. The pressure just builds, I think, when you're behind. And I think City felt that before they beat Liverpool, when they went as far as 9 points behind at one point. It really does tell. But I think at this stage in the season now, just to get the points on the board. I mean, these are all clichés, I know, but the clichés are true.
It's all going to go back to that Mane, that ball that was, what, 1 millimetre from not going in.
It's such an odd title race, Liverpool and City. Liverpool have not got results. They've got below par results twice this season, probably away at Leicester and away at West Ham. The other games they've drawn, historically, games you would draw, where City have have lost three games. You probably wouldn't expect them to lose. Maybe they've drawn away at Wolves and they're 1 point ahead when games are level. So, yeah, I think it's just going to go to the way.
You just get that image from Greg of how much Liverpool fans are staring at the league table, just staring at it. Can't do anything. You've got to wait until the game's played. Elsewhere, Saturday, Bournemouth, Burnley, Huddersfield, Leicester, Newcastle versus Palace. Burnley are in 17th, 5 points above Cardiff, with six games to go. So they got Bournemouth away, then they host Cardiff in a huge game. I mean, they don't lose that, then they're probably all right. Last four games of the season for Burnley: Chelsea, Man City, Everton and Arsenal. And they've only got 9 points from a possible 48 this season. So that gives Cardiff some hope, Paolo, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that running is really significant. But yeah, 5 point gap at the top of the table is one thing, a 5 point gap at the bottom of the table is different, because these are teams that aren't picking up points regularly. So I'd probably still favour Burnley, but it's definitely, the fixture list makes it interesting.
Newcastle Palace, 7 and 8 points above the relegation zone. Neither totally safe, but barring something frankly ridiculous from Neil Warnock's men, they should be all right. And Leicester with a decent chance to Huddersfield to win four in a row. Everton play Arsenal on Sunday. We've got the FA Cup semi-finals. Manchester City, Brighton. Does anyone give Brighton a sniff here?
No.
No.
I'm going to go no as well. Sorry.
Oh, that's such a shame, isn't it? Is it better to get done in the semi or in the final by Manchester City? Or do we give a sniff to the winners of Wolves-Watford? I think we do, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Wolves. No, actually both teams, yeah. I mean, Watford, I know they were under a huge amount of pressure against City, but the goal they went behind to, what was it, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, whenever that was a nonsense of a goal. And who knows what would have happened if that hadn't been given. You know, the Raheem Sterling offside.
Yes, yes, yes.
Either of those has a chance, definitely.
Wolves caused City problems at Molineux and they drew 1-1. So they'll look at that game and probably analyse it and see what they can do again to try and cause them trouble in the final if they get there.
Mike Keegan writing in the Mail this morning. Raheem Sterling's paid for 550 tickets plus transport for kids from his old school to go to City Brighton at Wembley on Saturday.
Yeah, it's a good thing to do. Well done him.
Yeah, he's had such a great season. And chat to Gareth Southgate after that England game about him. Just saying, like, how much he's seen him develop, not just as a player, but as an adult as well, as a guy as well.
Mm. The thing, Ennio Luco's column the other week, I thought was very interesting, that he hasn't changed that much as a person. I remember thinking he was quite mature at Liverpool when he first came into the team as a 17-year-old, and he was dealing with an awful lot of crap then as well about he was a father of three children, which just absolute lies. And he's been dealing with that now for 5-6 years, and he's had to have broad shoulders because of all the crap he's had thrown his way. But I think he has been just the same person throughout all this.
How do we see Watford Wolves going, Paolo? What's interesting, I think, is, and I think Watford fans would say, we've given so much praise to Wolves this season and almost none to Watford. Certainly a disproportionate amount to Wolves, and they're very closely matched.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what, 1 point in the league standings, and I think that'd be a fair comment that Wolves have attracted far more attention. And unfortunately, that speaks to all of our collective obsession with money, I think. And when we see a club doing what Wolves have done and throwing it around a bit, it's easy to get swept up in it.
In the Football League, big win for Bristol City on Tuesday night at Middlesbrough. That takes them into the playoff places. Borough dropped out of the playoffs at the weekend after being there since August the 9th. They've lost five in a row, one win at home in 2019. Tony Pulis says, we had 23 shots at goal tonight, 17 on Saturday. That's 40 in two games. I don't think I had that at Stoke for a whole season. Never mind two games. Rumours that Pulis might go.
I'm baffled that they were still in the playoff spots as late as this week. Because they've what, 11 games they've lost now this season? Yeah, they just, every time you sort of see them, they seem to be desperately struggling and failing to win. So the fact they kind of, we've won all these games under the counter when nobody's been watching, I think is great credit to them. But yeah, I mean, they...
Can Pulis keep them up?
The thing is, with Pulis, if you're not getting wins, what are you getting? And it's not much. And that, I think, is a problem that Pulis will always have. There's nowhere to go with his football if you're not winning games. And they've won 15, lost 11 this season, I think. So
and that the form since the turn of the year has been abysmal. So, yeah, he's. I understand why he's under pressure.
Much more importantly, in League Two, the Colin Calderwood revolution in full swing, a 3-0 win at third place Bury. I mean, nobody saw this. This is one of those where I get lots of tweets saying, "You bust my acca." I'm like, I wasn't there. I didn't. nothing to do with me. Anyway, the glory days are ahead. There was a full fixture list in Scotland last night. Celtic and Rangers both won 2-0 and 3-0 respectively. Some more throwing stuff at the pitch incidents after Celtic's second goal. Someone threw a firecracker towards the pitch. Mark asked the question, do you think Scott Brown is a scapegoat in Scotland after being assaulted by two Rangers players? Does anyone sort of sympathise with Scott Brown?
Well, no.
No one should be assaulted, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, Scott Brown is just this looming character in Scottish football, isn't he? I don't think you'd even see him as a person anymore. It's just this
caricature.
Nobody should be assaulted. And yet, I mean, Scott Brown wanted himself to be assaulted. He tried to be assaulted.
Yeah, I've got that little gif of him getting assaulted in that game and getting up and giving it the big muscle man walk now. So maybe, yeah, maybe that person's right.
I mean, when we're building the team of shithousery...
I mean, he's got a good claim for the armband.
He really does. Who do you give the armband to, him or Ramos? I'd love to see them in the same team.
Or Maradona. Maybe it's the only way you get Maradona to play is giving me the armband.
What did I hear this week? Scott Brown is a deep-fried Sergio Ramos.
It's a great line, isn't it? Maybe he can join this. I've got this Harlem Globetrotters dream that the old people at Real Madrid and Juve and Atletico all go to League One to see how they get on. Maybe Scott can join them. Here's a lovely...
It's Godin and Ramos at the back, isn't it?
Well, Juan Fran's quite old as well, isn't he? He's not as much of a shit. I mean, Chiellini. I mean,
maybe play back as well. Chiellini could play left back. He played left back early in his career, didn't he?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, build this team for me and send me a picture. A lovely story from the Highland League, 20 minutes into Lossiemouth's game against Huntley, from a Twitter account run by a Lossiemouth fan. Game delayed temporarily while referee Paul McAvenue spews in the centre circle. 2 minutes later, the next tweet, that's him done yakking up his tea and we're on the go again. The referee was replaced at half time. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll discuss what's been going on in Serie A. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Serie A, Paolo, full fixture list in Italy this week. But essentially, the main story is about the racist abuse of Moise Kean. Juventus won 2-0 at Calgary. 19-year-old striker and Blaise Matuidi racially abused by home fans who made monkey chants when the two players touched the ball. They both reacted to the abuse, but not terribly. Kean stood with his chest puffed out after he scored the goal in front of the Calgary Ultras. And after the match, Leonardo Bonucci criticised Kean, said it was, you know, sort of like Trump saying, oh, there are good people on both sides, and it was 50-50. Allegri said he didn't really hear anything and he was concentrating on the game. I just wonder what your take on the whole thing is.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many layers to this. I think the first thing to say is just that what Bonucci said was just colossally wrong-headed and frustratingly, even his apology for it 24 hours later, I think, still really suggested that he hadn't got what was so, I don't know, thoughtless in what he'd said.
Yeah, he said yesterday on Instagram, clarifying his feelings, yesterday I was interviewed right at the end of the game. My words have been clearly misunderstood, probably because I was too hasty in the way I expressed my thoughts. Hours and years wouldn't be enough to talk about this topic. I firmly condemn all forms of racism and discrimination. The abuses are not acceptable at all, and this must not be misunderstood.
Something to clarify just quickly. Within the stadium, there are a lot of journalists who I think are responsible, thoughtful journalists who've echoed this line that they didn't hear themselves racial abuse going on before Ken scores his goal. He scored a goal in the 85th minute of the game, and he followed that goal by going and standing in front of the Cagliari Ultras in the Curva Nord with his arms out to his side. That was the sort of the touch paper moment of this story, is because after that, these people who said they hadn't heard anything before said, yeah, okay, now we heard some things. Now, Ken's position, the position of Blaise Matuidi, is that there was abuse going on beforehand. And I think there's room to respect both of those positions. Look, this is a football stadium. It's noisy. He was certainly being whistled from very early on. He was definitely being sort of targeted for the sort of hostile attention that you might see handed out generally. But whether or not there were monkey noises before he scored the goal is something that is in debate. To me, it needs to be said because it's being sort of emphasized by a lot of the people who are defending. Well, there's very few people defending what Bonucci said, but certainly it's at the very heart of Bonucci's position of what he said in the first place, which is, look, Ken was partly responsible for this abuse because he went and celebrated in front of the fans. That's essentially what Bonucci says. For me, it's essentially irrelevant. It's only the same argument as someone who says, oh, that woman was wearing a short skirt, so she was asking to be raped. It's an absurd argument that has no respectable basis for being made. So even if you are taking the position that you haven't heard any racist abuse before this, the idea that Ken, who, by the way, I mean, I want to say this as well, this idea that he did something utterly heinous. I mean, he goes and stands with his arm out. All right, he's facing the home crowd who've been giving him a hard time. He's not running up and down, flipping them gestures. He's not mouthing off at them. He's literally standing there with his arms out. And Bonucci, of all flipping people to say something about it, a player who celebrates his goals every time by doing his wash your mouth out gesture, which, okay, fine, now at this point it's just an action, it's nothing. But that's a gesture to his critics. That's a, hey, look at me, look at people who told me I couldn't do this. And he's done it in games when there have been people getting on his back as well. So the idea that he, of all people, has some position of authority to say to a teenager, don't give any response to people who are goading you, is preposterous on its own merits. But he then, yes, comes out and makes this remark about, oh, well, it's 50% Ken's responsibility. And 24 hours later, as you said, he makes this statement where he says, oh, heat of the moment, short comments, wasn't properly understood. I think what's so disappointing about that is there's absolutely no indication in that statement that he's gone away and spoken to Ken, that he's, you know, listened to people who are telling him loud and clear, and a lot of other people. I mean, so Lilian Thuram, who obviously ex-Juventus player, has come up with a comment today to Le Parisien, which I think is an extremely powerful one. He says Bonucci is saying something which lots of people think black people deserve what they get. And I think that, you know, that sort of feeling, and you see it from Ken, you see it even more vividly from Matuidi, actually, in the moments that follow this goal, where he is arguing with Allegri. And Allegri, fine, again, I'm willing to take Allegri at his word when he says, look, I was focused on the game and I didn't really understand what was going on, which is what he said after the game. I'm willing to take him at his word on that. But Matuidi's reaction shows how much he's affected by it. Matuidi, who, by the way, was abused in this same stadium last January. The same stadium, by the way, where Sully Muntari, you know, exactly the same Cagliari Ultras, walked out of a game when playing for Pescara in 2017. So it's not like this is unprecedented that it's happened here. And I think that Bonucci's reaction to this just suggests that there was no actual willingness to enter into the mindset of his teammate, who, I'm sorry to keep repeating it, but he's a teenager. He's playing as a starter for Juventus for the first time in his whole career. To make out that he's the one responsible for this is just, yeah, it really, as you can tell, it's wound me up. And I think the reaction to it from a teammate speaks so loudly to why this problem is poorly addressed. I know a lot of people feel that Juventus should have taken this opportunity. They're 2-0 up in a game that is in a season when, frankly, even if they lost this game, it would make no difference, the fact they're going to win the league. A lot of people feel like this was as good an opportunity as you're ever going to get to make a statement and walk off as a team. I think that is sort of a hard one for me to adjudicate from sitting here on the sideline of, again, how much are the players on the pitch aware of what's going on? You get different remarks on that from different people about what you could hear inside the stadium at that time. But I do think that the least you expect is, after the game, a united front from people who are our teammates, just really making the point that this is unacceptable. And it's unacceptable if Ken stands in front of you with his arms out. It's unacceptable, frankly, if Ken does run up and down doing much worse things to you, which he didn't do. So I find the whole thing just so colossally disappointing, and takes away from the fact, by the way, that Moise Ken has had the fortnight of a lifetime in terms of breaking out as a teenager. This guy who was, not starting games for Juventus at all until less than a month ago. In the last four games for club and country, so two for Italy, two for Juventus, he scored four goals in the space of 11 days. He's gone from being a teenager with potential to exploding onto the scene. We should be talking about how flipping exciting this is and how, goodness, what if this kid's going to be having an Mbappe-style impact on this season's Champions League right away? What if he comes in now with Ronaldo potentially going to miss the first thing against Ajax? And it's all about Ken, who it may well be, because Juventus have like nine injuries for this game. He's suddenly an integral figure in that team. It's a hugely disappointing scene, and it's only made so much worse by what Bonucci has said. Without what Bonucci says, you're upset by it, you're frustrated by it, but you're still having a discourse of the attitudes of a minority of people in the stands, rather than, no, actually, even the players, even the ones who are alongside him, haven't understood properly what's going on and aren't willing to make a stand for their teammate.
How's this been covered in Italy?
I think it was really interesting to see the day after the game the difference between the international reaction and the Italian reaction. Look, there was definitely coverage of it. There was definitely condemnation of it. But it was, I would say, more equivocal. And I think there was a lot of reaction that didn't stray, without, you know, echoing exactly what Bonucci said, that didn't stray a million miles from that. There was a lot of this sort of talk about, and I would say actually repeated today in some of the reaction, some of the newspaper articles that were almost reacting to the international response, saying, look, inside the stadium, we didn't hear racist abuse until after the celebration. And even after that, it wasn't so loud. And in fact, that's what is going to be reported back from the match inspectors to the Italian Football Federation. It's unlikely that Cagliari see any punishment for this beyond a fine. There'll probably be a fine, but not necessarily more than that. Again, you know, you can't sort of summarize every individual reaction in one comment, but that is the broad scope of what we got from the big papers over the last couple of days. I think it's striking, and I think we've talked about this before. It was talked about after the incidents with England and Montenegro. You can't fix racism in a football stadium when it's a national problem, right? You can't remove racism from the political discourse, which has been very present in Italy in recent times, with a populist government effectively in power right now. You can't take it away from the social discourse, but at the same time, the opportunity is there with football to make clear and sort of effective high profile statements about something, and I think Italian football has already missed an opportunity with that in this situation.
Has there been any sort of official statement from clubs or the league? What should we expect from them?
Well, it's an interesting point that actually when Matuidi was abused by Cagliari fans just a year ago, he got an apology on Twitter from Cagliari's official account, which I haven't seen yet from them this time around. There has been no official position from the Italian Football Federation. The Italian Football Federation will, as I say, they have inspectors at every game. They will take into account what is reported back, and there will be some sort of response passed down by the Sporting Justice. But that process, I guess, has its own schedule, and until that plays out, I don't expect we're going to hear anything official from the Italian Football Federation.
Elsewhere on the pitch, Darius says, regarding Serie A, how was Icardi's comeback to Inter in terms of performance and general spirit? Haven't seen the game. I'm curious about the situation.
Yeah, well, he played great. They beat Genoa 4-0, really sort of in terms of what they're trying to do this season, get back in the Champions League, really significant moment probably, because it was a midweek round in which Milan, Roma, Lazio all failed to win. In fact, so did Napoli ahead of Inter, so very positive round for Inter. I think significant, a lot of people were watching very closely the relationship between Mauro Icardi and Ivan Perisic, who sort of presumed to be the lead of the anti-Icardi camp within the changing room, because one day Icardi was making some comments about teammates not giving him enough chances, and basically making what felt like digs at Perisic during the time that built up to him getting stripped of the captaincy. Anyway, Icardi set up Perisic for a goal. Perisic then seemed to pass up a few chances to send the ball to Icardi. So a lot of focus on that relationship going forward. But a team that has, you know, only one other real centre-forward in the side, Lautaro Martinez, who's currently injured, unsurprisingly looked an awful lot better when it had a centre-forward on the pitch. What was and will be continue to be fascinating for these last few games of the season is also the reaction of fans to him. Now, the Curva Nord Ultras for Inter, they put out a statement this week and also showed up at the training ground to sort of hammer it home that basically we're done. We're done with Icardi. He's not one of ours anymore, and that's it. And of course, for away games, the Ultras are the ones who tend to travel. So this game was away at Genoa. When Icardi scored his goal, cameras, of course, were trained on that section waiting for this moment. I thought it was a really sort of fascinating little human moment where you see some of them celebrate because their team just scored a goal, right? They start jumping and you have the Cappy at the front who are holding the megaphones who are immediately gesturing, no, you know, we're not celebrating this. Get down, we're doing it. And this sort of bizarre sort of crossover between human emotion and the politics of football, as it were, colliding, but certainly that is the official position of the Curva now. We're not going to celebrate his goals. Throw in on top of that, you know, whole bonfire, the just bizarre press conferences that Luciano Spalletti gives after every game. I mean, I've been saying it feels to me like he's almost putting on performance art at this stage. I mean, he went after the Lazio game at the weekend from talking about how he didn't need to listen to journalists' opinions of him because he's credible to his players and that's what matters. And you know someone, I think I said this maybe in my roundup, but you know someone's credible when they have to tell you four times in a minute that they're credible. And then, you know, after that game, he says, oh, look, Icardi's not Messi or Ronaldo. And then a day later, he says, oh, Icardi, who, by the way, he's also said, oh, I couldn't bring him back into the team for the first game back, now is a starter. Oh, well, actually, he is like Messi and Ronaldo to us. It's just, I mean, such a surreal, odd situation at Inter at the moment. I don't think Icardi can stay there beyond the end of the season unless something really significant changes. And I imagine that there's at least some part of the club's directors now who are just thinking, can we just get through these last few games, get the Champions League and have him play well so that we can get back to the 100 and something million release clause. It's about 110 million release clause in his contract as a valuation for him rather than what it might have fallen to after every club in Europe looks at this ridiculous soap opera and goes, maybe we don't want that around after all.
Thank you, Paolo. In Spain, some wild results in midweek. Real Madrid lost 2-1 last night at Valencia, who moved into fifth, 1 point behind fourth place Getafe. There was a 3-3, a last minute winner, and a 3-2 win, and a 4-4 between Villarreal and Barcelona. Barca fielded a pretty strong side at Villarreal despite busy fixture lists. They play Atletico, who'd already beaten Girona 2-0. Then they've got Manchester United as well, all by the middle of next week. Barca were 2 up after 16 minutes. Home side kept plugging away. They made loads more chances, actually, in the hour that followed. They were level shortly after the break. With 10 minutes to go, Carlos Bacca dribbled round Marc-Andre Ter Stegen to make it 4-2 to Villarreal. After 86 minutes, Villarreal went down to 10 men. Just before 90 minutes were up, Messi scored a magnificent free kick. Third game in a row, he's scored one. And then Luis Suarez banged in an equaliser with the last kick of the game with his left foot from the edge of the box. Great stat from Robbie Dunn on Twitter. Rayo Vallecano in 19th have dropped 29 points from winning positions this season. They've managed to lose 7 times when they took the lead and draw on 4 occasions. In Germany, the quarterfinals of the German Cup competition, the DFB Pokal, saw RB Leipzig, Hamburg, Werder Bremen and Bayern Munich get through to the semi-finals. Bayern in a ridiculous game where they beat Heidenheim of the second division 5-4. They went ahead after 12 minutes. Then they had their centre-back, Niklas Süle, sent off a minute later after a VAR review. Heidenheim went 2-1 up. Bayern were 4-2 up. Heidenheim equalised with less than 15 minutes left. Robert Lewandowski scored the winner from the penalty spot in the 84th minute. Here's a question from Max, who says, thoughts on the Moroccan League Balotelli selfie celebration that resulted in a restart without them and the opposition penalty. Have any of you seen this?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
It's tremendous, isn't it?
It is. I mean, clearly the ref shouldn't have allowed it, but at the same time, I understand why he was just sick of kind of a team spending hours over the celebration. And then I think I'm not convinced it was actually even a foul. I think it might have been a dive. It's difficult to tell because the picture quality is not great and it's quite a long way away. But it's essentially as the ref's going, oh, for goodness sake, right, I'm just giving a penalty.
Yeah, it would have been so much better had the penalty not been given and they'd just scored.
Yeah.
But it was still fantastic.
I mean, this ref at least appeared to wait for some, if not all, of the players to run back onto the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe he did wake Lord 11 back on the pitch. I mean, and be like, all right, off you go.
It does look great because essentially they've, you know, if they are on the pitch, they're all playing left wing. Yeah. You know, which is, you know, when you've just gone one up and you go, nothing silly, next five, it's a strange way to start. Just to then see 11, 10 players just absolutely sprinting back into position. Yes, it's ridiculous refereeing, but it's also tremendous fun.
I'm aware that there are certain sections of it that may see me as some desperate killjoy anyway, but we got to stop that kind of celebration, haven't we? I mean, it's just silly. But as soon as you start using objects, I don't care if it's a mask, if it's a camera, if it's a phone, just it's a yellow card.
I mean, if it goes into whose line is it anyway, you know, given a feather duster and a toilet seat and you've got to create something, I'm more in favour of that than I am going on social media.
See, I feel like things like that, I'm okay with the first time. I think that's the point. Like when Totti pulled a selfie in front of the cover, I said, you're like, okay, it's innovative. All right, that's once. The problem is that once you're sort of repeating someone else's act, then you're like, okay, now we're just going to, yeah, I don't know, indulgence. If it feels like it's something that's, I don't know, a one-off moment in time, yeah, the novelty I can go with.
But you've got to think, footballers, you know, it's a bit like the all the handshakes at Tottenham, right? Footballers have got so much time. So actually, it's good that they're using it in a sort of creative way. I'm with you. The first time, you know, do whatever you like. But once that's been done...
No, I think just no objects.
Okay, so yeah. You're happy with, like, that Icelandic team that did the fishing celebration?
I mean...
That too far? That is the first time you see it, you think that's very clever, right?
Or referees can just restart a game 30 seconds after the goal.
So just a handshake.
Yeah.
Well, 45 seconds, whatever the time should be.
See, it's a challenge to see how quickly they can post an Instagram story, though. I mean, like, it takes me 5 minutes to put a picture on the Guardian Sport Instagram account. Like, these kids are, you know, these are like the messies of the social media world.
The trouble for me is, like, if I had that in my mind, I would just be thinking about that. I just wonder if it would actually affect my game if I think, if I do score, it's very unlikely. I've got to go there and, you know, I've got to
dry my thumbs because they're sweaty.
So I've thought that loads of times, like how many, I've even just thought with shirts underneath shirts, which especially before they were giving out bookings for them all the time, how many shirts with messages have we not seen?
Yes, it's
how
a very good question.
Great slogans have been lost to us?
But I was thinking you just get a bit, you know, like, I'm a real stickler. Everything's got to be right. Mm. You know, I've got to have the right socks, the right little socks, the right shin pad, the right tape, everything. So if I had to wear an extra T-shirt, I'd be too hot.
Yeah, and you've got this celebration you're waiting to do and it's November, it's fine wearing a T-shirt underneath. But then you haven't scored and you're into May and it's really hot. And you just can't do it anymore. You're just going to have to scrawl on your own chest with a marker pen.
Mm. Or just get a tattoo and then it's there forever, yeah. Isn't it? Right, that'll do for today. Thanks, Greg.
Cheers, Max.
Thanks, Paolo.
Cheers.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.